Hi, everybody. Hi. Thanks for coming out. And this volume is appropriate, you feel? Up? Can anybody who has any control over sound turn that up? Oh, apparently there's someone back here. Hey, how's it going? The sound guy, everybody. Thank you. Really. Sound guy's not available to pick up his award, so I will be accepting it for him. He wants to thank Steve Jobs and God. Thank you very much for coming here today. I hope you guys are having fun at the Big Mac World, getting your little light computers and what have you. I don't remember calling this Living with Data. That's what it says in the book, so that's what I put together. At the time, my wife was very close to having our daughter, and Paul Kent was nice enough to demand that I speak here, so I made something around that title, and I hope that this is mostly what you were looking for. And really, special thanks to Paul for making me do this. I'm thrilled to be here, and I've been a Mac nerd since, I don't know, probably the late 30s. I go way back. I love the Mac, and Paul and Kathy have both been really charitable to have me here. So today I want to talk to you a little bit about your life. But first I want to tell you about a friend of mine named Mike. That's Mike. His name is Mike Montero, and he works at a web design company here in town called Mule Design. You probably know Mule. They make these really cool shirts that lots of people wear, including Oliver Sacks, who I just call the Sack. These are great shirts. You can get them at muledesign.com. The problem is that Mike had a trouble a few weeks ago. He's a designer, he's the co-owner of this company, he's the creative director, he's an artist. And Mike felt like his entire life was disappearing into a world of stupid meetings. It seemed like every time Mike turned around, he's going into a meeting, he's coming out of a meeting, somebody's calling a meeting's being rescheduled. And we're not talking about the kind of like little 30-second iterative check-ins that we enjoy working in a small company. We're talking about old school 1999, sit around the whale table for 3 hours. Meetings, often on no notice, no agenda. It's really like the greatest hits of like my personal nightmare. And this started to drive Mike crazy, because like I said, he's an artist. This is a guy who likes to draw things. He is, as we like to say, a knowledge worker. He's someone who adds value to information, and it drives him crazy to see his entire company going up in the flames of nonstop meetings. Especially the kinds of meetings that are not put together in the most mindful of ways. So Mike is a world-class smartass, as anybody who follows him on Flickr knows. And when Mike gets a bee in his bonnet, that's where you tend to see what's on his mind. So one day, Mike decided that he was going to create something called meeting tokens. And it was Mike's contention that within his company, every Monday morning, all of his employees would receive a small bag filled with poker chip-sized wooden tokens that would allow them to take the attention of their colleagues on a minute-by-minute basis. Every token would represent 15 person minutes of time. If you want to spend 15 minutes with somebody, give them one token. Want to spend 30 minutes with two people, that's four tokens. If you want to have an all-hands monster meeting that takes 2 hours, you probably can't do it, because he's not going to give you enough chips to be able to do that. But if you could find a way to keep your meetings a little more modest, to have fewer people for smaller amounts of time, to plan a little bit more carefully, then you'd be able to make your chips last until the next Monday. Is this a terrible idea? Yes, mostly. Would this ever happen? Will it be implemented? Probably not. Would one day of this plan lead to Mike's employees meeting at him at his desk to hit him over the head with his own little bag of time? Almost certainly. But it's an idea that really resonated with me. I do 43 folders, this site about personal productivity, and I've really been kind of struggling with trying to look at the themes that in my mind kind of run through the 43 folders-esque experience. And Mike's one afternoon of being a smartass accidentally kind of really pulled this together for me, which is he made me finally realize that a lot of my problems come from the fact that my attention has become a little bit too much of a bargain. It's become far too easy for people to take my time and attention, and it's something that's started to drive me a little bit crazy. And as I go and I talk to people about it, I realize it's something that's on a lot of people's minds right now. And it's my feeling that when the cost that's associated with someone's time and attention is set too low, or when it's not set to anything at all, you're bound to see a lot of waste and abuse. The waste tends to come from the person who hasn't yet realized what kind of value that their time should have, And the abuse comes from a world that could care less and will just do anything that they can to take that time and run with it. Extreme examples, spam, right? Nowadays, all it takes is a few good zombie Windows machines, and you can have a spam network of your own out there in the world. It costs virtually nothing to send spam. A lot of people say that if spam cost anything to send, it wouldn't exist anymore. The profit margins on spam are not great. It's just that they don't need much of a response because it doesn't cost anything, right? Telemarketing. Could you have had a telemarketing company in 1940? Could you have had an international telemarketing annoyance company? No, because the charges for long distance were too costly. It took technology like voice over IP to make it really easy for somebody on the Indian subcontinent to call me during dinner every night. Technological changes, job changes, a lot has happened in the last, let's say, 20 years to really upset the balance of scarcity and plenty in our lives. And so if you're the kind of person who, like me, as a knowledge worker, you're seeing a disruption in particular in the amount of access that people have to you. It's my contention that if we do not find a way to wrangle our time and attention in such a way that it stays directed on the things that are valuable to us, we will be entering a world of pain. And as anybody can tell you, you do not want to be entering a world of pain. This is a problem that everybody's got right now. I mean, everybody I know. You can sit around and go, whatever, email's not a problem for me, or I've got it all wired. But I think most of us, a lot of us, at least a lot of people who have IP addresses and visit my site, have a lot of trouble keeping their time and attention trained on the things that end up being really valuable. And I think a lot of us are really seeking a certain kind of new mindfulness that'll help us keep a bead on that in a way that's healthy and sustainable. And I think the people who suffer this the worst right now are probably knowledge workers. And that's just a 75-cent term that was coined in the early 60s by Peter Drucker, who basically said he was identifying this kind of new creative class of people who add value to information. So we're talking about artists, writers, programmers, developers, the people who send me press releases all the time when I ask them not to. These are all people who are doing knowledge work of a kind. If you need a shortcut for identifying knowledge workers, look for people with girly, smooth hands who can go to lunch whenever they want. That's probably a knowledge worker. So this is one of the core challenges right now, because knowledge work writ large is the ultimate first world profession, right? You've got this extraordinary amount of information that has an education that's taken you to this certain kind of job, and then you're given a lot of freedom compared to like most people's jobs. You've got an extraordinary amount of independence. That autonomy, as I say, is a first world problem though, because you may find yourself kind of wandering from place to place, and you never know, you might find yourself on Wikipedia at 2 a.m. covered in pizza crust. It's hard to keep ourselves trained on what we need to be working on. I think that a lot of what leads people into knowledge work is they end up having a certain kind of, they're really good at solving a certain kind of problem in a certain kind of way. And a good company will give, or whoever hires you, whoever signs your check, is going to give you a lot of latitude to do things that you want to do it, right? And the neat thing about knowledge work is you can still be part of a team and working with lots of different people, but ultimately you're still responsible for your own little piece of the pie, right? This has led to what I have started to call the black box career, which is the ultimate first world gift and problem. And when I say black box, I'm not talking about the kind of black box they find in an unfortunate flight, but the kind of more like black box testing. And the notion of the black box is you have, there's things in your life that are input. People come to you and they have requirements for what is required of you. That gets jammed into the black box, the notional black box that represents the stuff you do. And then, of course, after a little bit of work, you deliver perfect results on time and on budget, and everyone's very happy. Nobody cares what happens in the black box, right? As an ex-boss of mine once said, Merlin, we're relatively satisfied with your work, but we wish you would stop showing us quite so much of the mental sausage being made. And in my experience, people don't want to see the mental sausage. And that mental sausage means whatever your process is in terms of how you're getting the job done. But there's a funny force multiplier that a lot of people are dealing with right now that I think is fascinating. I mean, how many people in this room right now, you don't need to raise your hand, that's dorky, but how many of you right now are doing exactly one job for exactly one person? You wish, right? You got dotted lines running all over the org chart. You're replying to different people. You might have some kind of one of those weird vertical jobs where you're checking in with people all over a company. God bless the support people. I don't know how they ever get anything accomplished. But if you're dealing with multiple teams, multiple bosses, clients outside, if you're doing anything with more than one little sort of squadron, little squad of people, you're additionally responsible for maintaining all of the relationships between those people. And when necessary, escalating scheduling problems, escalating availability. You don't have a nanny. Nobody like sat you down and assigned you somebody to kiss your boo-boos when you have to have three things due at one time. It's an additional challenge on top of all that. And that all happens in the black box. Boss number 7 does not care that boss number 3 really wants this done. That's all up to you to figure that out. And that kind of overwhelming feeling, I think, is carrying a lot of people away right now. And if you're somebody like me, that can lead to kind of a difficult situation where, I don't know if you guys have ever experienced this, but have you ever had a day where you're really, really, really busy, and the busier you are, the harder it is for you to do anything because you don't even know where to start? And you're so riddled with self-loathing and procrastination that all you do is surf Wikipedia? I mean, people tell me about this. I don't personally suffer from that. But this comes back to our time and attention, right? These are two words I say over and over. I apologize. It could be a drinking game. I would encourage you to drink anyway while I'm speaking. But time and attention are incredibly finite resources. They're not only the backbone of any successful career for a knowledge worker. I think they're two of the most precious resources that we have as a human being. And I don't know a lot about economics. I'm not going to lie to you. I went to a really fruity college in Florida where you get credit for baking bread and making macrame. So I don't know much about economics. But I do understand enough to know that when you have a limited supply of something, you need to really take care not to deplete it. And time and attention are two things that, like money, we tend to not notice until they're in very short supply. If you've ever had a brain-crushing deadline, you know what an hour feels like. And you know that as that hour is dwindling, there's a physical sensation associated with how much you're totally not going to get that done. You know that feeling. And I would suspect that you also know the feeling of dwindling attention. If you've ever, like me, had the misfortune to suddenly find yourself reading the 3 a.m. reading the Wikipedia entry for Andrea Bocelli, and you don't know why. And I use the phrase find yourself because that's what I feel is happening. It isn't as though you have chosen to trail off down some combination of BitTorrent, YouTube, and Wikipedia into this circle of absorption. You find yourself there, and you say, my goodness, what has happened to my attention for the last 3 hours? Here I have found myself. And yet, those precious resources are there dwindling, they're going away, you're not going to make a 26-hour day, and as much as you'd like to think you really can do it, there's no way to do more than one thing well at any given time. I think as I stand up here, Mr. Smarty Pants, with the inexpensive jacket, telling you about your life, you get this, you understand what I'm saying, I know you know this. In the abstract, but do you know it like the way you know money, right? Like, hypothetically, let's say you're walking around in the hallway at work, and one of the douchey guys from PR comes up and goes, hey, give me $100. And you're like, what? No, well, I'm not gonna give you $100. Why would I give you $100? Do I owe you money or something? You know, buzz off. But what if he goes, hey, could you meet me in the conference room for a meeting? If you're like me, you'd probably go, yeah, whatever, you know? Because you know what it feels like to have $100 and then not have $100 anymore. You have a sense of $100-ness that once it's gone is gonna leave you a hole that's very memorable. You have a much less well-defined idea of lost some amount of time to douchey PR guy because of meeting. You don't have as strong a sense of that. And yet, I'm not trying to tell you that time is money, because whatever, that's kind of a cliche. But I will tell you that I think something is at stake here that's actually more important than money, which is the idea that ultimately, I think you can tell a lot about a human being, and if you were the sort of person to judge people, you could judge a human being based on where their time and attention goes. 1 year of blogging is not going to tell you nearly as much about a person as 1 year of time and attention. Show me somebody's web history and RSS feeds for the last year, and I'll tell you a lot more about them than what they claim to believe on their blog. And I got the RSS to prove it. And so, again, I don't know a lot about economics, but I do understand the concept of opportunity cost, which was explained to me as a child by Monty Hall. Opportunity cost is just basically the idea that if there's some kind of a resource that's finite and you choose to apply it somewhere, that means conversely, there's any unlimited number of ways in which you won't be able to apply it. Again, something we kind of understand, but do we really get that? Do we understand that by allowing our time and attention to go to things that are not valuable and to in fact cede access to ourselves, to other people and entities that don't have the respect for our time and attention that we wish they did, that goes away, and so we never get to see door number three, which is sad, because that's where the donkey is. That always made me laugh. This is an example I use in pretty much every presentation. One day Joel Spolsky will probably find me and punch me because I keep using it, but Joel Spolsky is a really cool developer who uses this excellent metaphor in the service of talking about creating an application, talking about software and how you decide to put features in or not. I take the example, and I'm using it in terms of deciding how we use our time and attention. So let's imagine that your time and attention is like a box, right? It's a box that's got a certain number of cubic inches of space in it that represents the totality of time that you've got to do stuff. And everything that you choose to do represents a little block, a little bit of time, like a tiny little task, a tiny bit of time would be a small block, and a big block would be lots of time. But the thing is, the box isn't going to get any bigger. No matter how many blocks you want to put in it, there's only so much that's going to fit in there. And so what I want to try and talk to you guys about today is, first of all, trying to make sure you never put a crappy block in your box. And second, if you do find that your box is really filling up with crap, how you can start taking some of that stuff out and trying to kind of reassess the way that you approach that stuff. The actions that you perform in your life are a reflection of your time and attention and your interests. You can say all kinds of things are important to you, but whatever it is, what you think about and what you, it's kind of what Aristotle said, you know, you are what you repeatedly do. And so, you know, if we allow ourselves to become a little bit more mindful about what it is that we're doing, I think we can do some pretty extraordinary things. So I don't know, what's the strategy here? What do we do to try and wrest some of this back? We understand that these things are finite. We understand that I think everybody has, you know, a lot of these motivational speaker kind of guys with the big teeth, they like to come out and talk to you about all these capital letter nouns about values and excellence, and I have no idea what excellence is. I don't even know what that means. But they come out and they got all these fancy ideas about this pie in the sky and kind of best case scenario, and I feel like a lot of us are just really struggling, kind of spinning our wheels, trying to just get the stuff that's on our plate off. I think we all ultimately, we don't need some guy in a suit to come tell us what's important to us. We know what's important to us. I think what things like life hacks, if you're familiar with the term, I think what life hacks, when they're done well and aren't just jerky top 10 lists, I think what a good life hack does for you is encourages a certain kind of mindfulness and a kind of synaptic leap that helps you take the stuff that you know you should be doing and ensure that that's the stuff that you are doing. To quote my friend Jeff Veen, it's making the right thing the easy thing. And I think that's a lot of what we want to try to do with our time and attention. I realized today in the 5 minutes before I came here, that this is really a lot like defensive driving. Anybody ever have driver's ed take defensive driving? Maybe not. It's all right. You guys are tired. By the way, I'm not going to go on too long. I know that I stand between you and the beer, and so I am not going to be up here for very long. Defensive driving is this idea that there's a certain way in which you can choose to operate your vehicle such that you minimize the harm that you do to other people, at the same time that you protect yourself by hopefully never getting into a bad situation to begin with. It's kind of like Aikido on wheels in some ways. And it's a great idea, because basically it says, well, you know, it's crazy out there. You know, you got a lot of nut jobs and people who are doing unexpected things. But the most basic, as I understand it, the most basic tenet of defensive driving is, I'm never gonna make my decisions based on what somebody else is doing. I'm gonna take care of myself and make sure I'm not screwing anybody else up, and I'm not gonna like rely on them to do the right thing. I think that's kind of what we're talking about here. Just take it in terms of email. Like, if everybody was a little bit less douchey about email, the world would be so much better. If we were all just a little bit more mindful about the emails we sent to others, we'd get better email and we'd send better email, and we'd all be able to create a culture. Oh, now I'm getting all like open source and pie in the sky, but I do believe that. Now, that said, there's something I always feel like I need to say, which is that just because we have defensive driving doesn't mean that all the drunk drivers are going to get off the road. And the fact of the matter is, there are always going to be intractable problems, and there are always going to be impossible people. And there's no guy in an inexpensive corduroy jacket who can stand up here and honestly tell you that there is a magical trick that's going to make bad people go away. But I really do believe that there are things that you can do for yourself that will help you to accomplish the things that you want to do. Fairly modest things, like being able to go home at a normal hour and not having to read email all weekend. There are things that you can do to make this easier on yourself. Does anybody think that looks just a little bit like Chris Breen? The bouffant of wisdom, as we like to call him. It's not. So in the time we've got here, by the way, I don't like to do a lot of throat clearing. I'm going to allow lots of time for questions. You will stay here until you ask questions and we have a conversation. So I'm not going to stand up here and bark at you for more than another probably 15 or 20 minutes. I'd like to have lots of time for questions and then let you go early to drink. So I want to talk about two tracks for things we can do here. And these are just some ideas I've been trying to put together about how we kind of try to go to the next level of getting away from just like, you know, here's 15 neat things you can do with a timer, into like, how do we start thinking about our life a little bit differently, right? Instead of just tricks for how we, metaphorically, instead of trying to buy bigger buckets to capture all the leaks, like how do we start fixing the roof? And that's the kind of stuff I want to look at on two tracks. So one theme I've been thinking a lot lately is this idea of renegotiation. Inevitable question, people who've looked at getting things done before, Getting Things Done book, David Allen, Getting Things Done, come on, raise your hand if you have, don't be scared, okay, that's fine. Getting Things Done is this terrific book that I talk about a lot in 43 Folders. And there's, without getting into a huge amount of detail, because you're understandably sick to death of hearing about it, one of the great concepts in Getting Things Done is that if you are in a situation where you have more stuff than you can do, you have relatively few options about what you can really do. But one of the best options is renegotiation, which is the idea. So there's the whole like, well, you can do it, or you can cancel it, or you can change it a little bit to turn it into something that's a lot more doable. And the more time that I spend thinking about this stuff and talking to people who actually do things in life, not just have blogs about it, I realize that renegotiation becomes a huge part of being successful in knowledge work and, in my opinion, in life. But renegotiation to me, I hope this doesn't sound inspirational because I don't mean it that way. But I think in a lot of ways, renegotiation means starting to own the stuff that happens to you. Did you guys see that Tom Cruise video, by the way? Have you guys seen that new? That's on Gawker? Go check it out, it's incredible. I sound a little bit culty when I talk like this and that concerns me. You have the, let me ask you a question. How full is your wallet? I really do believe that you have the power and the responsibility to start owning the stuff that happens to you. And I think that there's a certain kind of attitude of victimhood around a lot of the problems that people have in areas like knowledge work, of just feeling kind of put upon. And maybe your best reaction to that ends up being, I'm gonna come in Saturday and spend frickin' 2 days just answering email so I can feel caught up. And that's so not an answer, right? Like instead, how do we find a way to own that and say, you know what, I'm not gonna spend 2 days answering email. I'm gonna totally change this game by renegotiating what my relationship with this is. Because I think once we start renegotiating, first we gotta own it, then we renegotiate it, and that allows us to kind of reshape the stuff that we allow into our world. And that's really what you're doing. As much as you want to blame your douchey boss, you let a lot of stuff into your world. You let RSS feeds into your world. You let YouTube into your world. You let TiVo and Netflix into your world, Merlin. You have let all of these things in. And so before you complain too much about all the stuff that takes your time, it's valuable to understand what you've seeded. Anybody here got a website? Website? Does your website have a contact form? Is that not the biggest mixed blessing in the world? It's so awesome to get email from people, but it also can be so overwhelming, especially between the hours of about 11 and 7 when the crazy's all right. We've all ceded extraordinary access to the world. Just a quick rat hole. You think about if you gave your business card to somebody like in the 50s, they'd have like your little, you know, Starwood 7, 3869, and they'd have like, you know, your title, right? But now you send somebody, give somebody a card. They got your home number, they got your mobile number, your office number, your fax, your email, your web address, and maybe your AIM, you know, your instant message name. Almost any of which they can choose to call, or SMS, or otherwise employ at any time. right? Because it's this asynchronous way of communicating. You can email anybody whatever, whenever you feel like it. There's no longer any kind of prohibition against that. So we end up being the ones who have to kind of sit there and latch the screen door to decide what kind of access we want to allow people to have to us. So that's just a long roundabout way of saying I think that's where negotiation starts. Back to this attention issue. Remember I was saying I think you can tell a lot about somebody by where their attention goes? There's a subset of that, which is you can tell an extraordinary amount about somebody by who's allowed to have their attention anytime. So like right now in your life, don't respond to this, it's not a test, but who in your life right now is allowed to interrupt you anytime they feel like it? Right? And you'd say to yourself, ha ha ha, I'm a very successful freelance entrepreneur guy. I make my own way. But have you ever seen this? You know what that says right there? It says, ding! And it go, oh, I heard the ding, I better go look. And what does that ding mean? Just from looking at it, can you guys tell? I don't know if you can see it says ding. Well, who's that email from? Can you guys tell? Oh, that's right, you can't tell because it's all the same ding. I forgot. It could be bacon because a zombie bit you. You know, it could be like some totally creepy guy who saw your picture on Flickr. It could be your mom and her hips broken. It could be my uncle, a prince from Haiti who has a great deal of money he'd like you to hold. Could be a bounce message. It could be a Rolex. It could be penis medicine. It could be anything. Right? It's the same goddamn ding. Pardon my French. I'm sorry. But do you find that vexing? And so what's your answer to that? Like, I know you guys with the neck beards and those tiny t-shirts are going to be, well, I've installed Growl, and so I know to a level of granularity who is emailing me. Well, more power to you, Stallman. But my thinking is that ding is not very smart. And if you're following my tortured line of reasoning here, you have no idea who just made that ding happen. So you say to yourself, no, I'm not that guy. I'm not that guy who lets the ding stop him from what he's doing. From my important work reading about Andrea Bocelli over on the Wikipedia, I will not be distracted to go check this email. But think about how many things in your life are represented by a single ding. Anytime we have notifications going on that are taking us away from what we're doing, that's one super quick way to break your time and attention. So again, this is if you follow 43 folders, if you're one of the 5 or 6 people that visits the site, you know that this is a theme that comes up a lot. And I just mean this as a specific example of a much larger pattern, which is the idea that part of this renegotiation is understanding who gets access to you, understanding when they get access to you, and understanding for how long they get access to you. And for you to really turn into a total productivity ninja, you're going to have to be able to make those decisions very quickly. But you're going to have to make those decisions. And as long as you're letting the ding take you away, you're not being a ninja. You're being that guy. This is another fairly specific thing, but I'm going to encourage you, if you use mail.app, to go to your preferences and look at this little area here. And I'm going to encourage you to set check for new mail to manually. And I'm going to suggest that you change new mail sound to none. And I'm going to suggest that you not let your mail checking run your life. Because if you leave that in the default state that mail.app launches in, it will check for new email every 5 minutes. Now, they didn't teach arithmetic at my fancy college I went to, so I had to check this on a calculator. But that's about 2,000 notifications a week if you're somebody who gets a lot of email from Haitian princes and what have you. I don't know, do they have a monarchy in Haiti? I don't even know. Do what you can to try and minimize the notifications that you don't really need, and consider trying to gang certain kinds of activity into things that are more convenient for you, okay? So this is something we talk about a lot in Inbox Zero, which is, if you go to inboxzero.com, there's a lot of talk about this. But the basic notion here is to not let other people decide when it's time for your attention to go to them. I think in some kind of notional dream world, there will be a day where we eventually get incredibly granular control over this stuff. And if you want, well, with some extra time, we'll talk about some totally awesome gorilla tricks, I can tell you, that will let you get away with cool stuff like this. But in general, try to tighten your screen up a little bit for all kinds of notifications. And if you don't believe me, just try it for a morning. Try it for one non-critical morning. You're sitting there listening to Car Talk, right? Try it for one Saturday morning. Don't check your email every 5 minutes. And I'll tell you what happens, because I think this is a good rat hole. If you let your email accumulate even for an hour, as opposed to checking it every 5 minutes, remember this, the ding? If you don't get the ding, everything is so much less of a fire, you have absolutely no idea. If you give yourself 10 minutes every hour to deal with email, you're going to discover an extraordinary thing. You're going to discover that a lot of stuff is not nearly as important as it seemed when you were checking it. And you know why? It's because you let your attention go there. And the moment that bell went off, like a little Pavlovian little dog, that's important now because your attention went there. Don't be that guy. How many times has this happened to you? Henderson comes along and says, I got a quick question for you. And you say, well, I don't have time right now. Maybe let's hop in and do a meeting a little bit later. Can anybody here tell me what happens in iCal when you create a new event? What's the default time for a new event in iCal? How long? Speak up. It's an hour. That's right. If you create a new event in iCal, the default time is an hour. Have you ever thought about this at all? I have. That means that if you're really lucky, you can do about 6 things a day, according to iCal. You're going like, oh, what's the big deal? I just change it. That's crazy. Same for Google Calendar. I have no idea. For on Outlook, I don't know. They might be on metric time. I don't even know. But in iCal, a default time of an hour for every event? Can you get your brain around that? Can you see how a default setting can completely disrupt the way people think? What if my friends in Cupertino took my advice and said make the default 15 minutes? Still nice and around, but you can change it up or down. Imagine, like for the people in your life who are sucking up your time with meetings, imagine if their default time for a meeting was 15 minutes rather than an hour. Maybe it's a small thing, maybe you think I'm overstating this, but I just think that really encourages a certain amount of sloppiness. Consider challenging some of the defaults in your life. Stuff that you're doing now that's taking more time than you would like, consider finding a way to kind of hone it down a little bit. And if anybody here has friends, I've already filed this with friends at Google. Like, if you guys know anybody who makes calendars, talk to them about this. Maybe let's make it configurable. But geez, wow, 1 hour, that's rough. I'm a big fan when we're renegotiating. This is such a great move. This move saved my life. Tallahassee, Florida, 1995. I was one of the few people who knew how to make web pages. And so despite my terrible antisocial skills and lack of a personality, people would seek me out because I could make a web page for their band. And I ran into a terrible problem, which is I kept saying yes to everybody all the time. Yes, 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 right? Do you do that? Do people come to you and you go yes, 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 yes? Because you're like me and you want to be loved. You're a Mac user. And so this is an attitude that will not scale, right? And you maybe haven't learned that. If you haven't learned that yet, you're not busy enough yet. Because you will discover that if you keep saying an unqualified yes to whatever people ask you to do, man, I'm largely talking to myself here because I still really struggle with this. But it's my feeling that one of the coolest moves that you can do in renegotiating your life is learning how to qualify your yes. And that means it is perfectly acceptable to, instead of yes, say kinda, maybe, later, or a little. Yeah, actually, I am kind of interested in doing that. Could you give me a little more information about how much time that would take and what your expectations are for turning that around? More information, ninja move. Maybe I might want to do that. You know, I'm kind of busy right now. Could you make a note to give me an email in 6 weeks and ask me again? And maybe that would be a good time to talk about that. You know, I am interested in that, and here's what I'll do. I really like the charity you're with. And what I can do is I can give you 10 hours of my time to use over the next 60 days any way you want. Let's plan that out on a call, a 15-minute call. Asking people for more information, great move. I can't tell you how many calls. People are nice enough to call me because they want to do interviews and stuff. Or they want to, like, I get these totally, like, weird mystery meet business development calls. I don't know what people imagine that I'm going to do with business development. But I get these, like, hey, zibba zabba. Let's confab, zip zap, drill down, open the kimono. And invariably, I write them back and say, I don't know who you are, but if you wanted to tell me, why don't you give me 5 bullets on what you'd want to cover in 20 minutes? And they're like, they're really unaccustomed to having to think about what they want to talk about before they take your time. It's not disrespectful at all. The first time you do that with somebody, it can be really surprising. But man, you have no idea the people that I've done that with who then start doing it all the time with people. It's just a way to show respect to people, to say, yes, I'm interested in this, but you know, let's talk about how what we're really going to do here. The earlier you can drill down on that kind of stuff, I use drill down on ironically, the better off you're going to be. Just the general message here is try to own your stuff. You know, I mean, nobody's going to come along and fix this stuff. Nobody's going to give you a nanny. On a lot of the stuff, you're just going to have to cut bait and let stuff go. I mean, you are the only person who's going to be the governor of your attention. And I've deliberately tried to avoid a lot of the super molecular life hacky tips about how to do things like in mail.app, turning off certain accounts except for once a month, how to actually go and open several different RSS accounts depending on how much you want to like really follow stuff. There's a million different ways that you can start segmenting your attention better. Be happy to talk about those. But at a high level, just start thinking about renegotiation. Well, I'm going longer than I thought, so I'm going to pick this up a little bit. You know, a lot of times, the place that I get my ass kicked on these talks is when I sit up here and wave my hands around and have all these really great ideas that I'm able to do sitting in my house. And somebody comes along and gives me a terrible dose of reality about working in an office. And it's become kind of a little sport for people to come and freak me out with horrifying stories of what happens in offices. It's awful. It's like, I don't know, like being a Vietnam reporter or something. I met a woman who has 30 minutes a day that she doesn't spend in meetings. And I still can't get to sleep some nights thinking about that. My hand to God. And she's not exaggerating. She showed me her calendar. Lots of one-hour meetings. Paul Kent said, will you do this? And I said, what time and what do I wear? And he said, you're going to be talking about vision. So I feel like I can really wave my hands around and talk abstractly, if you'll forgive me. I think we should start talking at a medium to high level about what kind of ways we want to see the culture around these tools change and what kinds of ways we want to start working better together with each other. And people come to me with some really confounding problems sometimes, and I have to just kind of shake my head because I don't know what the answer is. I don't know what the answer is to having a really malignant corporate culture that causes people to feel like they need to do really, really awful things in order to feel like they're respected by their peers. And, you know, a lot of this stuff is kind of hilarious and jokey and gosh, aren't we all ADD? But at the end of the day, there's stuff going on here that's really hurting people. And there's stuff going on where people are working in places for 5, 10, 15 years in really awful situations. And it's not necessary at all. So I do not have a tonic for how to change the world or America. I don't have a way to even change a corporation. I do think one way to start seeing those changes affected is to start at the sort of platoon level, or if you will, at the squad level, right? So I don't know if you ever heard this statistic, but supposedly Americans hate Congress, but don't really so much dislike their congressmen. They have better feelings about their congressman than they do about Congress in general. And in my experience, that's very much how people feel about work. They think everybody at their company is a total douchebag except for the people that they work directly with. And I think that's awesome. That gives me hope. And you probably feel that way. There's always a couple difficult people. But by and large, if we stay at a job, we tend to really like and respect the people that we work with. So this is a very roundabout way of saying, I think the place to start with some of this stuff, if it were 1999, I would say low-hanging fruit, but I'm not going to say that today. Is to work on our culture. One way to get better at the culture is to start with really, 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 really small stuff. What my friends at Adaptive Path would call quick wins. So let's say you want a team of 5 or 6 people, for the sake of examples. Start looking at stuff that everybody agrees is a pretty big problem with a pretty small solution. Right? If you go and went out to lunch with your group of colleagues, there'd be stuff that keeps coming up that's not strictly personnel related. A lot of times, there is a little bit of sand in the gears that would not be that hard to clean out. Start looking for ways in which you're seeing communication hangups. Start looking for ways in which you feel like everybody's kind of almost on the same page about a certain way of doing things. It's the very beginning, and what I'm saying is don't start with controversial stuff. Don't start with why does Vern smell like an enchilada. Don't get into the emotional stuff. Start out with really kind of small stuff that everybody can agree would be a win and would make everybody feel happy and wouldn't be too disruptive. Right? You with me so far? Start small. I tend to think I could do a pretty long talk on the idea of team standards. And by standards, I don't mean rules and laws. I just mean things where we all agree on doing things kind of a certain way for the ease of use. Are you a top quoter or are you a bottom quoter? Do you use the subject line a certain way? Do you agree on standards for how you edit the wiki? Is there a certain time of day that you should just not bother anybody inside the company? Start talking about this stuff and maybe consider not exactly formalizing it, but really kind of almost lightly documenting it amongst yourselves, because you're going to be bringing new people on. If we learn anything from software development in particular, you learn that culture is one of the most important things there, and you have to pass on the values of your team to whoever else comes along. If it were me, and it's not, but if I ran a small team, every time a new person joined our team, we'd all go out to Flingers, and we would talk about how our team works. We would talk about how we use subject lines. And for the love of God, you should really be using subject lines well. Subject lines can save your company. I swear, if we all got a little bit better about using subject lines, if you just got the six people on your team to get better about using subject lines, if you all could agree once and for all, are we going to top quote or are we going to bottom quote? Or are we just going to, you know, guys, know what I'm talking about? Don't get John Gruber started on this. He will have a stroke. But a lot of people disagree on how you do basic stuff about communication. And I'll tell you, nerds can get pretty wound around the axle on stuff related to geeky communications things. Try and find some standards that everybody can agree on. And I think really those standards have to include how we use our tools, okay? So it's not just when is an appropriate and inappropriate time to reach me, but what should you use to reach me? I've noticed a lot of people use their away messages in AIM to kind of let people know how they want to be contacted. I think that's kind of a neat idea. So whatever it is you decide, I think every team finds its level with this stuff, but I say start having this conversation. Let's all agree. From now on, we never send another time-sensitive, I need this today thing via email. I'm just tossing this out. Let's all agree as a group of five people that from now on, email is mostly for FYI stuff and non-critical stuff that I could get to every day or two. Let's agree that from now on, all the stuff that we need to, everything that we can push into an RSS feed that people need to update, it'll be in an RSS feed that they can search whenever they want. Let's agree that if I really need your attention, I'm going to get you over the AIM. Anything on the AIM that goes longer than a couple minutes, we're going to get on the phone. You know what I mean? Start having these kinds of conversations, because I think that culture could take you a long way toward having little easier ways with your team. This one's relatively specific, but I think it's an interesting one. Start thinking about times when you agree that people are not obligated to respond to communication. Start thinking about time. What if, for the sake of argument, we said Tuesday mornings from 8 until noon, anybody can send me whatever they want, but I'm not going to respond to it. I'd prefer you didn't send me stuff. But we're going to give each other time to work on a specific kind of project and not be bugged and not feel like they have to stand over their email and check it every 10 minutes. It's going to be firewall time that your team is going to use to protect you from the outside world. You could even station a guard. You could have one person who's known throughout the organization as the contact person for your team during those times, however you want to work it. Another idea, I can't decide if this would work, but I think it's an interesting idea. I've been thinking a lot about the idea of, I can't decide whether to call it office hours or the reverse meeting. But I really like the idea of, instead of a team constantly being fragmented and having to go off to an orthogonal meeting inside of their organization, what if you had a couple hours every week where your entire team sat in a room, worked on their stuff as they needed to, and then anybody who needed to interact with the team could come to them rather than them having to go out. Start thinking about innovative ways that you can mix this stuff up in such a way that everybody gets what they need faster and without a huge expending of time. And then get out there and share the culture. As much as possible, make sure that the other people in your organization are learning about what you're trying and what you're doing, and see if maybe that starts kind of crawling up the ladder a little bit. That's a terrible image, but I love that album, and I've been waiting to use that in a presentation for a long time. So renegotiation and culture, the two big themes. I'm going to wrap this up in a minute and let you guys talk. But I really feel like the fight is on with this stuff. You know, if you don't have a problem with this stuff, God bless you. But a lot of us are really struggling, you know, tooth and nail to try and get time and attention trained in the right place. And I think it's a problem that's not going to go away. I think that we're going to just see an escalation of this stuff. And I think for as long as you permit your attention and your time to be something that anybody can steal away with you from you without any cost at all, you're just going to spend your entire day dodging bullets. And that is not a way to live. In my estimation, I have spent approximately 3 tokens of your time on this. I owe everyone here 3 15-minute tokens. And I would like to say thank you, and let's talk a little bit. You may applaud. If you need to go smoke or burp or Sparta, or get a Michelob, you can go. But I would love for you guys to hang out and talk. I wanted to deliberately leave lots of time for us to chat. So I don't know if we have a, do we have a microphone here? I'm not sure that we do. So talk to me, you guys. Who's got a question? Yes, sir. That's a really good question. His question is, he feels like he's doing pretty good with his inbox management, but what does he do about the outbox management, which is to say, how does he handle follow-ups on stuff that involves other people? And it is a great question. This is something that comes up a lot, because right now, email kind of sits at the center of a lot of our activity. And I think a lot of people could really make the case that email is, in addition to being the lingua franca for how we communicate, has really become kind of the command center for how we conduct almost all of our action. It all touches email at one time or another. I think I mentioned Getting Things Done, that book by David Allen. He has a concept that I like a lot and use a lot. And you can almost think of it as, instead of a, how can you put this? It's almost an intransitive to do, right? He calls it a waiting for. So it's somewhere in your system, ideally, you would have a way to say, I emailed Sue on the 15th, and by the 20th, I need to hear back from her about this thing. So you're onto something from the beginning, which is that you understand that just because that's off your plate for the moment doesn't mean it's not coming back. And the best way to think of any email you send to another person is as an intransitive action, or as, you know, that idea of like kinetic and perpetual, or kinetic and, yes. And so really, this is a way of saying this is going to come back to me, and it's going to be its potential activity, because it's going to come back to me. There's several ways you can do that. I'm not here to pimp OmniFocus that I worked on. Disclaimer, I helped them in designing OmniFocus. One thing I love in OmniFocus, because it's what I use, is I can select a whole message in mail.app, hit a key, and that becomes the note in a task with a link back to the mail, which I like a lot. I gotta tell you something, as much as I rag Entourage, and God knows it deserves it, the thing that I used to love about Entourage, and I say this over and over, so I'm sorry, but it's you can clip anything to anything. Entourage is so great for like, this person, add to this task, and add this meeting, and add this document. That's something that's still kind of imperfect with mail and tasks, but there are several applications, I think IGTD does this too, there's several applications out there that will ease this for you. The most important thing, in this long-winded answer, is you must track that as something. Give yourself a tickler. Give yourself some kind of alarm. And so what I try to do is say, okay, well, I try to, anytime I'm waiting for somebody to get back to me about something, I try to understand what task that's stopping me from doing right now. To me, that's the most positive way to think of it. So I say, okay, well, if this person got back to me right now, what would I be able to do? And so be prepared to mark that in such a way that when it does get back to you, you can immediately jump on that. And so that's why, again, something like OmniFocus I like, because as soon as I do tick that off, then that next action populates into my my list. You can track that any place, though, whatever works for you. But I think that's a hole in a lot of people's systems, actually, is thinking like, oh, this is off my plate. I don't have to think about it anymore. But if it's something you want to get done, you should also take the ownership of it. Yes, sir?
I work in an academic environment, so my answer to that is stop being passive, start being active, and maybe sometimes really setting expectations of when you're expecting something back. And that may not work in a world where it's really hierarchical, but we'll do projects, get them all done on time, not hear back from the professors in 6 months, and everyone accepts that as that's fine. But we're finding that if we start setting expectations and really making them agree at the get-go around those expectations, so you really take an active role versus a passive role. My question is, and it ties in with your comment about OmniFocus, we live in this connected list-making world, which makes us all even more accountable. I'll show up and all of a sudden my calendar is full of stuff. How do you go about renegotiating when you live in a world where you don't control the horizontal or the vertical along the
Yeah, well, the question is, how do you try to kind of wrangle the stuff that's getting thrown at you when it far exceeds your ability to do it? That's probably what should have been the first slide today, is that that's hard, and it's so hard that it's actually not possible. And there's a certain kind of hope in understanding that how screwed you really are in some ways. I think the way of madness, and the way that a lot of people are slowly or quickly losing their minds right now, is thinking that they can do it all. And I think, you know, that's why to me something like David Allen's Getting Things Done is attractive, because it really encourages you to think about stuff in terms of, first of all, think of it in terms of a very specific outcome. And then to be able to break stuff up into granular enough steps that you can manage your attention being dispersed over a large horizon, not at the same time. You need a system that you really trust to be able to manage that level of engagement. And then the renegotiation comes in, because you've got to say to people, I mean, you hate breaking, nobody likes breaking a commitment. One great way to not break commitments is to try not to get into them in the first place, which ties into your remark, I think. I'm a very new father. My beautiful, she's in the back, if you want to meet Eleanor, she's in the back with my wife. And she's really cute, my giant baby. A great piece of advice that I got from somebody for when Eleanor gets older, somebody told me that the best thing you can do with a kid, you don't ask them if they want to go to bed, you ask them what color jammies they want to wear. And I think that's kind of what you're describing in trying to be proactive about the way you manage action, is to say to people, it took me a while to pick this up, and I do this all the time now, instead of going like, you know, sad sack, like, hey, so should we catch a meeting sometime in the fall? You go like, hey, would Wednesday from 9:30 to 9:45 be a good time for us to talk about these two things? Oh my God, look what I just did. I just got incredibly specific, and I just made it so easy for this person to write back and say yes. I took all of it. If it's something you really want to get done, be incredibly specific with people. You know, it's so much easier to try to, you learn this as a project manager, believe me. You really want to try to phrase things as much as possible. My friend Michael taught me a trick when we were in college. We were waiters at this place in Sarasota, and Michael taught me the dessert trick. He taught me how to be a really good waiter. You're always nodding. Hi, how's your meal tonight? Everything's good? Yeah. So you think you'd like some cheesecake? And there's something, I'm not sure where he picked this up, but it totally works. Make it palatable and easy for people to agree with you. And the other little dash of seasoning to add to that is make it clear to people that you're willing to do a little of the work for them. People love this, especially people that are your boss, right? As much as possible, try to frame stuff as, here is like, this is also kind of a tenet of brainwashing, right? Take everybody's hope away and then show them an exit. So, you know, we've had to make some resource allocation changes, you can get really good and passive aggressive at this, where you go like, well, there's really two ways we can handle this. You could go ahead and approve an extra $35,000 in the budget, or we could probably spend about 10 minutes on Wednesday figuring out what we can cut out, and I recommend these two things. Is that a good time to talk to you? It's like, yes, please. Yeah, but I mean, boy, being active about this stuff, that's the game, man. Is like just figuring out what it is that you can, if stuff isn't the way you want it, like what do you have to change to get it where you want it to be? And then like do it in the easiest, most lazy way you can possibly stand. Hey, is that Kathy? Hi.
Hey, Carla, what do you think about Twitter?
I love Twitter. I can't believe you'd say such a thing. I Twitter's a funny thing. What do I think about Twitter in terms of, is it a total time sink? Is that the question? I have lots of complex feelings about Twitter. I think a culture in which we're really that interested in what people are doing from minute to minute, did they have Thai food, are they running, have they had a bowel movement, I don't think this is a level of detail that I need from too many people. And that's why I choose to use Twitter slightly against the grain, which is to say really stupid things that 5 or 6 people like. Twitter though, boy, I will jump from Twitter to Facebook and say, boy, there's some stuff out there that will really suck as much attention as you want to throw at it. And if you are going to get involved in stuff like that, there's a couple ways to handle it. One is to say to yourself, okay, I'm going to give myself a budget of time that is so completely free to just go screw around. And I don't have to be responsible to anybody about how I spend my time doing that stuff. There's a thing I've written about on 43 folders that I call the procrastination dash, which is the notion that if you're having trouble getting stuff accomplished, try working really, 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 really hard for 10 minutes, just 10 minutes. And then for 2 minutes, you get to screw around. And then you come back and you work really, really, really hard for 10 minutes. And then you get to go screw around for 2 minutes. And you use a timer, which sounds really stupid because it is. But if you need it, well, it's like making fun of people who use corrective shoes. It's unseemly. You know, people like us, some of us really need these kinds of affordances. If you really enjoy, if you're deriving joy out of Facebook, and for about 2 weeks, I really liked Facebook until it started freaking me out. And I canceled my account as much as they would let me. I'm still on there somewhere, so friend me. Boy, if I could have friend not be a verb, I'd be such a happy guy. That and impact. But if you're going to do Twitter, if you're going to do any of that stuff, this goes back to kind of the, you know, first principles on this stuff, which is you can do whatever you want as long as you know you're doing it, right? The only thing that I'm really advising against is finding yourself not doing what you want to do. Do you know what I mean? Does that make any sense at all? Like, it's okay to do whatever you want. You just don't want to constantly be going, holy crap, what happened to my morning? Andrea Bocelli, I'm still reading this? I don't even like Andrea Bocelli. And you know, I just got one quick note related to that, and this goes so much for RSS. There's a tendency that people have, especially people who have blogs, people who do stuff that requires any amount of online stuff. People really like coming up with excuses to spend time on stuff that they don't really need to spend time on. And you know, you can say, well, you know, my job's very important. You know, I order parts for boats, so I need to spend a lot of time on Wikipedia and YouTube. You can fool yourself with that, and that's okay if that makes you happy, but I think you're much better off to go, you know what, sometimes I'm just gonna eat a bin of ice cream, but I'm not gonna eat a bin of ice cream every day. That's kind of the trick. Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah.
So how is this different, and how can we motivate ourselves to not?
So the question is, how is any of this stuff that I am theoretically saying is a good idea, how is that like or unlike the notional gym membership that we do and then kind of ignore? We have these aspirations to do things and then we kind of let it go. Done badly, there's absolutely no difference. No difference at all. There's a concept that I've heard about, I don't know if I'm using the right term, but it's a term called, I think it's called aspirational marketing, which is an idea that completely fascinates me. And it very much explains the concept of why people go to websites about productivity that update 24 times a day. Which, if you give that a minute to sink in, is pretty penetrating. Aspirational marketing is the notion that it isn't 17-year-old girls who read 17 magazine, it's 12-year-old girls. And in fact, you will discover, if you examine the demographic information, that there aren't that many millionaires that subscribe to Millionaire Magazine. Same here. Now, my question to you is, have you ever been really fat?
No.
It's okay, I understand if you wouldn't want to say you were. If you've ever been really fat and lost a lot of weight, you never want to go back. So part of the thing with the gym membership, you are totally right on. The other side of this is that one reason idiots like me stand up here and bark at you about this stuff, the reason that people who've been on these squirrely diets and lose weight stand up here and tell you about it is because their life has changed a little bit in a way that's been really important to them. I'm somebody who, I've never been diagnosed with ADD, which I think is unconscionable. If they made a Nerf football-sized Adderall that I could buy at Costco, and I would get it. I'm always looking to people like my, like I said, I've said this before numerous times, but I look to people like my grandparents, and I think about my grandmother who always, you know, had her glasses on a little unfashionable jeweled, you know, string, and my grandfather always carrying a notebook, and these are people who realized that they had certain liabilities and decided to go and do something about it that was fairly modest. I think for us to change to stick, a gym membership, you know what's weird is the gym membership works for some people because expending that money makes them have some kind of like, there's a term for that, like what makes people fill out a form once they start filling it out. You UI guys know that. But the truth is that it's different for everybody. And the motivations that make somebody want to do something like join a gym are not so different from the motivation that makes them make macrame or buy an SUV. I think a lot of people do it because that's the thing to do at the time, and they feel like they're joining some kind of a zeitgeist, and people like Oprah help make this even more of a thing. And then you have the law of attraction. Don't even get me started on the law of attraction. But at the heart of it, I mean, I think the thing what this stuff comes down to is you meet these true believers who will sit there and kind of lecture you about life-changing stuff. The truth of the matter is, I think when life hacks work well, they work well because they're teaching you that there are outsized changes you can realize in your life from incredibly modest little tweaks. And if you become mindful enough to start understanding what the stuff is that's really getting you caught up, there are some relatively simple things you can do that don't involve driving to a gym. And so I think that it requires a certain amount of honesty with ourselves. Everything that I'm talking about today will fall apart if you are dishonest with yourself, right? I've said this in the Inbox Zero talk too. You don't get an empty inbox by imagining that you'll respond to email someday that you know you're never gonna respond to, right? And when somebody sits there in your office and asks you to do something that you know you don't have time to do, are you gonna say yes? I mean, a lot of this requires a certain amount of I think candor with ourselves. I'm rambling a little bit, and this gentleman has a question. Yes, you, sir.
One of the enjoyable things about reading your website is just how often you fall off the wagon like the rest of us. You're very candid about the fact that you rarely execute this very well.
Even while I'm driving the wagon, I fall off
right.
It. Yeah.
I made the wagon, but I just jump off the back. So the question is, can you speak a little bit about how you get back on the wagon?
Yeah. Sure. His question is, like, when you're trying to, and I mean, like, for those of you who have no idea what we're talking about, so 43 Folders is this site that's about personal productivity and other stuff. But it's not, I like to think that it's not about personal productivity in that jerky sort of, like, capital letter way. It's really about trying to affect, most of it is about trying to affect fairly modest changes to stuff that's kind of hanging you up. And the question is, like, how do you get back on the wagon when you're not doing well? And it's a very, very difficult situation. For somebody who, if you've ever been in that kind of slough of despond where you're procrastinating about stuff, and like, you guys all seem really smart and you have professional haircuts, but if you've ever been in that place where you really start to hate yourself and you start to think, I mean, I'm just being square with you. It's a horrible place to be. To be at a place where you feel like I am completely incapable of doing the most fundamental things in my life. It's an incredibly painful place to be. And if you ever find yourself in a place like that, I'm going to specifically suggest one book called The Now Habit by Neil Fiore, who's a... I was really freaked out to find... He's a hypnotist. But it's a great book. Don't let that stop you. You're going to stop procrastinating. But I'll tell you why I like this book. To me, like, The Now Habit and Getting Things Done are two books that are like the 1-2 punch of how to get you off your ass. If you feel like stuff is really falling between the cracks in your life, man, these are books that really help you get a handle that you can really grab onto. And the reason I like The Now Habit, I bring it up in the context of getting back on the wagon. I find this such an inspiring book to occasionally just pick up and read a little bit of, because Neil Fiore explains procrastination in such a way that you understand how everything you know or think you know about motivating yourself is so basically wrong. And if you're like me and you come from Ohio and you have this kind of weird Midwestern voice in your head yelling at you all the time about what you're doing wrong, you tend to think that the way to motivate yourself is to make yourself feel worse about something. And you realize the secret is not to make yourself feel worse, and the secret is not to blow smoke up your ass, but the secret, if it is a secret, is to figure out how to, instead of create a sense of peril, which makes you nervous and have to go to the bathroom, instead, how do you create a sense of safety? And how do you say to yourself, what do I need to do to make this something that's not going to freak me out anymore? Because the thing that makes somebody fall off any wagon and stay off that wagon is the fear of failing again, I think, in a lot of ways. And if there's a ninja move inside the ninja move, it's becoming an excellent recoverer. And I don't mean that in the 12-step sense. But like one way to get great, if you watch a really great manager Like, it's somebody who recovers very quickly from stuff. And it's somebody who's able to have anything come at them, and sort of like the mind like water concept in GTD, there's somebody who's able to respond like they need to, and then get back to what they need to do. And I think the Now Habit, I don't mean to be pimping this book so hard, but I was really inspired by the idea of how can I, instead of yelling at myself and trying to create more anxiety, what can I do to try and find the modest steps that I can take to get this done in a way that's going to cause less stress rather than more stress? And again, I just come back to that idea. I know this sounds like a platitude, but I really do believe a lot of it means being honest with yourself. And if that being honest with yourself means you need to quit reading all these stupid productivity sites and just go try something else, you should totally do that, right? It's whatever works for you. But it starts with understanding what it is that is fundamentally wrong with what you're doing right now. And you can't do that by thinking that you can fool yourself. Maybe one more question? We'll do two more questions. Yes, ma'am.
Well, you said you were going to share some of your questions.
Oh, yeah. Oh, nice.
And then in your label, there's just your
dates. In Google Calendar?
Yeah.
In Google Mail. Gmail. That's clever. Did you guys see it? I don't know if this is a photo job, but somebody posted something today on a blog where it appears there was something along the lines of an add task menu that appeared in the dropdown in Mail. Anybody seen that? It's going to be something interesting to watch. I've always thought Google needed a light task management app. Hey, does anybody here love tasks in mail.app? Is anybody here loving it? I'm just curious, because that still seems like a terrible mess. I will tell you a couple things. These, I feel like Chuck Garabedian. I don't know if you guys like The Simpsons. I'm going to tell you those things that those fat cats from Wall Street don't want you to know. There are some, by virtue of my position, we'll make this quick and get out of here so you guys can get a beer, but there, by virtue of my position as the perceived basket case in charge of productivity on the internet, I get a lot of really interesting anecdotes about what people are doing. And so we'll call this the beginning of the unofficial part of the show because some of these are execrable. But one of the best tricks I heard, one of my tricks, mail.app, I have created a rule in mail.app that looks for the phrase for immediate release anywhere in a document or attachment or mail and deletes it without me ever seeing it. Talk about a first world problem. It would not be gracious for me to stand up here and tell you what happens when you're fortunate enough to have a blog that people like to visit, but boy, there's some pretty unsavory PR people out there. This PR that I had to see dove within one day of making that rule. Start looking for places where you can make a rule about something. Don't make the rule so crazy that you'll miss good stuff. And I'll tell you a good trick. If you're thinking about doing a mail.app rule or a Gmail rule or whatever, the nice thing in Gmail is you could first make a smart folder, smart mailbox, that would show you what would happen if you did that. And it's extraordinary. I had like 5,000 press releases that people would send me. If you ever visit my site, it's just tacked full of things saying, I don't know how to beg you enough to please not send me press releases. I'm literally begging you. That changed my life. Another one of my favorites. I have heard this from probably 3 different people, and it's such an awesome trick that everyone is scared to admit they use. I think people are mostly doing this in Outlook. Create a rule. Every email for which I am not the sole to recipient goes into a little gray folder that I look at once a day. Do you follow me? Not the sole to recipient. If anybody is CC'd, if anybody else is in the to line, if it detects anything that this is not just an email to me, I look at that folder once a day. And there are people, I'm not recommending that. You will so get fired if you do that, probably. But like, there are people who tell me that is the only way that they are getting anything done, is to get rid of all the like people who are trying to cover their ass by CCing everybody. It's the only way they get anything accomplished. There are other things you can do. There's a lot of like urban myths around meetings. I think there's a lot of terrible ideas about how to try to make meetings shorter. I think at one point, Mina Trott from Six Apart was allegedly making people drink a large glass of water before every meeting. And the first time someone had to urinate, the meeting was over. You hear people talking about chairless meetings, that could work. You hear people talking about scrums, which is kind of an agile development idea of having these kind of short little meetings every morning. I'll tell you one thing you can probably afford to do is if you have anything that looks like a standing meeting in your life, my God, reevaluate whether you really need to have that meeting that often. And if it is a standing meeting, you should make everybody stand. I'm going to let you go at this point. I'm just going to mention one more thing about this is one of the biggest honors of when Mike put these together, these chips. And he claims he still might go ahead and make these and sell them on the site at muledesign.com. But one of the biggest honors I've ever had was that in every set of chips that he sells on the site, you get one red chip, and it's called the Merlin. And anytime you set it down, the meeting is immediately over. Thank you very much. Thank you, I appreciate that.